I have so much confidence and pride in the young women I see, and there's some amazing women who will go out and really have an impact on how we think, how we take care of ourselves and the world and each other.
Welcome to Season 5 of the Women on the Move podcast. I'm your host, Sam Saperstein. In this season, we're giving our financial health a checkup with some phenomenal women giving us the prescription for financial wellness. We'll speak to experts on how to educate your children about money, how to address debt, and how to save for home ownership. It's a masterclass on understanding and managing your money. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Sion Bylock, president of Barnard College, one of the nation's top liberal arts colleges for women in New York City. She's also a cognitive scientist and one of the foremost experts on performance anxiety. We had a great conversation about the importance of financial education and wellness for college students and how she uses her research to educate and empower women at Barnard and beyond. Sion, thank you so much for joining us on our Women on the Move podcast. It's so great to see you again and welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start out with the fact that you're the president of Barnard College, a liberal arts college for women in New York City. And the mission of the school is to develop students to become agile, resilient, responsible, and creative in order to lead and serve their society. So that is a wonderful mission, and certainly for women, and we very much support you. So I would love to know, what are your priorities when you think about that mission? What are the things as president you strive to get done?
It's great to talk about Barnard, which I think is really a singular place. And the reason it's singular is because we are a small college focused on empowering women to explore their passions across the arts and sciences, but we're also part of this larger Columbia University community. So you really get the best of all worlds. And because we're part of this larger community, our classes are cross-listed. So Columbia students take classes at Barnard and vice versa. And our faculty actually are tenured at both institutions. And students at Barnard come out with a diploma from Barnard and Columbia. It sets them up so well. Our women come out with a voice. They've learned to really put their best foot forward, and they've learned to navigate all sorts of environments. And it's really exciting to see them come out and go on to change the world. Right now, we're focused on several different aspects of continuing to enhance and promote what we're doing at Barnard. The first is just something that I think should be an inherent priority of any high-level institution, and that's to make sure that regardless of one's financial means, they have the ability to attend if Barnard is the right place for them. And so Barnard is highly selective. Last year, we had 9,600 applications for 600 spots.
Wow.
It makes us one of the most selective of any college or university in the country. But we're need blind, which means that we don't look at financial need when we accept our young women, and we actually meet full financial need, which means that we enable students who come from a variety of backgrounds to be on campus. And the reason this is so important is because decision-making, whether it's in an academic context or a context where the bottom line is a profit margin, we know that decision-making is better when you have diverse voices with diverse lived experiences at the table. There's so much research showing that. And so part of what doing great work is, part of academic excellence is having young women from different backgrounds who identify with different racial backgrounds, with different socioeconomic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds, you name it. It's about putting these students together and having them push each other on their ideas. And financial support is just such an important part of doing that. The second is around health and well-being, and making sure that our students are set up physically, mentally, and financially to go out and conquer the world. The third is around Beyond Barnard and ensuring that our students have knowledge and access to internships, to job opportunities, to connecting with our 35,000 alumni, to connecting with jobs in New York City and across the world. And it goes to this idea that your major doesn't dictate your career path. When I got to Barnard, we had a career setup that's common at most institutions. You went one place if you wanted to go to med school, another place if you wanted to go into finance, a third place if you wanted to learn about grad school and the humanities. And that is a broken model because it assumes that you know what you want to do. And so we blew that model up. We created this new entity called Beyond Barnard. And it's really a one-stop shop. Students go from day one to connect, to learn about different career paths, to connect with women who've had successes and failures, to connect with internships and jobs and grad school. And it's lifelong. So women who are coming in and out of the workforce or alums can go there. And it's been really successful. It got written up as one of the new models of career advising. And so our goal is to continue to push that. And then finally, my fourth goal is something that's close to my heart and so important, is around really pushing our eminence in math and sciences. A third of our Barnard graduates are math and science majors. We now have 10% of our graduating class computer science majors.
Wow. That is a very big deal and huge. Yes. Number. So we have to celebrate that right here and go ladies for doing that.
Yeah. And then my last statistic that I just love is that Barnard ranks number 9 out of any college or university in sending our students to graduate with PhDs in math and science per capita of our graduates. We are training the next generation of women scientists and computer scientists and doctors. And I firmly believe it comes from a place of being at an institution where there just aren't boundaries, where who you are because of your race or gender is not taken as any indication that you will not succeed.
Those are really meaningful statistics and outcomes. So congratulations on really reaching those goals. I think that's tremendous. You also have a really high percentage of the student body that's first generation students. And that is great. I mean, that is so impressive to get these students into a college environment and be the first in their families to go to school. So can you talk about how you specifically work with these students who might not have the resources and the background to be successful right away in school?
We started a new program this year that I'm really excited about, and it's called Access Barnard. And it is a home, physical and virtual, for first generation, low income and international students. So populations that may not have experience navigating American higher ed. And the whole idea is that it's one place students can go to get help with thinking about everything. Maybe they need extra money to go to a conference, or maybe they don't understand how to get help from a professor. Maybe they want a mentor. Maybe they need a laptop and they're across the world for virtual learning right now. Maybe they want a class on budgeting as they live for the first time on their own in an apartment in New York City. And we started this program because there were all sorts of different places students could go on campus to get support. But what we continually heard from students, and it really resonated with me as a cognitive scientist, is that it was demanding to have to kind of figure out and navigate the system. It's like a cognitive load. It's like driving and talking on the cell phone, which is not a good idea. It doesn't matter if you have a hands-free headset. It's the cognitive part, trying to attend to all these things. And it was exhausting to go to one office, to not know if you're going to the right office. And we had these resources that weren't always getting used. And so we listened to the students, we put this in place, and we're so excited about it because it's really a place for students to go so it can take the pressure off of them to navigate the environment and really create it structurally. And I think it's a lesson to be learned, not just at colleges and universities, but across corporations and businesses. Like oftentimes opportunities or pieces of support pop up in lots of different places. And if there's not a centralized way to get to it, it sort of puts the onus on the individual, on the employee, rather than making it part of the corporation. And that's really important for both speaking to the importance of a diverse community, but allowing people to access resources in a way that's not exhausting.
Can I ask you about leadership? You know, there's been research that shows that women who are in single sex settings, all women's colleges or high schools, do better than women in co-ed environments. And I'm wondering, you know, what do you think about when you think about that research, and why is that important to you running Barnard?
Yeah, you know, there is research showing this benefit, and then there's some research that doesn't show a benefit, right? And so for me, I'm a cognitive scientist by training, and I study what happens in the brain and body in stressful situations. So I'm always asking about the data. And for me, what I have really found is that there are certain things that happen at a place like Barnard that help propel women into the next stage of their career, that help propel them into leadership roles. And these sorts of things could happen in co-ed environments. They just tend not to. And there's three of them that we've identified. One is seeing other women in leadership roles. So at Barnard, 60% of our faculty are women. This is true in the sciences And when you see women who are excelling in fields where they're not traditionally represented, it's true in economics. When you see women leaders, it lets you know that people like me can do this. So that's the first one. The second is that we explicitly tackle issues around gender and stereotypes. We do a lot of debunking, a lot of talking about how these ideas that men are more suited for certain careers and women for others are just not true. We talk a lot about gender in all its forms. And there's research that shows when you debunk some of the stereotypes, they're less likely to impact you. And the third is that I liken it to hitting a tennis ball against a wall. Once you get really good at it, you don't think about it. And when gender is not the issue, when the smartest person in the class and the least well-prepared person in the class, when they're all women, it just is not something you focus on. And everyone speaks out. People learn to have a voice in such an important way. And what happens is that when you get into a co-ed environment, which our students do when they're here, because they often have classes with Columbia, gender is not at the forefront of their mind. So instead of being a woman leader, our students are just leaders. Instead of being a woman scientist, our students are scientists. And I think there's something really powerful of being able to put that negativity aside and just push forward.
So you mentioned you're a cognitive psychologist by training, and we have loved hearing from you at some of our events that we've done together. So one of your areas of focus is combating self-doubt. And we'd love to have you explain that concept here to our listeners and what people can actually do around this topic.
Yeah. So especially with respect to women, we tend to be really hard on ourselves, right? I always talk about this idea that some of the things we say to ourselves, we'd never say to a good friend, especially when we're trying to build them up. We are mean to ourselves. And so I study a lot what happens when we have those doubts and how we can actually promote thinking more positively and having self-compassion, right? Giving ourselves a little bit of a break. You might think, well, this is just something psychological. It's not real. You know, this doesn't matter how we talk to ourselves. But my research actually shows that our brain changes when we're worried and when we have this negativity, and it prevents us from performing at our best. There's actually a biological basis to this worry and self-doubt. Areas of the brain that are neural alarm signals, they take all the juice, and essentially areas of the brain that we need to focus are robbed of that juice. So the idea is to quiet down those alarm signals. And so how do you do that? I have a book called Choke, where I talk about a lot of the research on this, but turns out there's psychological tools and pretty simple psychological tools that we can all embrace to quiet down that self-doubt. So as an example, one is just how we interpret our bodily reactions. So sometimes when we're walking into an important meeting or presentation, we have sweaty palms and a beating heart, and it's very likely to think, oh crap, I'm about to bomb this. But research shows that if you can reinterpret that physiological response, it turns out that heart is beating because it's shunting blood to your brain, and that sweaty palms indicates that you're excited and ready to go. If you can just remind yourself of that, then you actually perform better. That simple trick is enough to change how you perform. It's enough to shunt the resources to the parts of the brain that you need to focus and take them away from the parts of the brain that distract you. That's just one example. Another example is talking to yourself in the third person, like distancing yourself a little bit. I often say to myself, Sion, you can do this. You've done it before. You can do it now. And it turns out that distance actually gives you a little bit of perspective. And I liken it to sometimes when you write a really mean email or text to someone, but you don't send it, but you just feel better after you've written it. It's sort of like you're able to pull back and reassess and reframe. And it turns out we can use these techniques in our own life and actually perform better.
And how do you put some of these concepts into play with your students? Are there classes on this? Are you teaching them these kinds of things throughout their undergraduate career?
Yeah. I mean, at Barnard, it's a highly intense place, and our young women come in at the top of their schools and in their experiences. And most of them haven't had a lot of failure experiences, to be honest. And they've had a pretty sort of straight track, right? You go to high school, you go to middle school, you go to college. And so we spend a lot of time through lots of our classes and also through the activities we offer outside of class, really orienting our students to the idea that success is not a linear path. that your major doesn't dictate your career path. I remember it was really eye-opening when we were able to show statistics to the English department that, you know, over 90% of our English department graduates go on to get jobs within 6 months or go on to grad school. And some of them are in publishing, but some go to work at Google or JP Morgan or all over the place, right? And so your major does not dictate your career path. And I'm really excited that we just announced a new center. It's the Francine A. Lefrak Foundation for Wellbeing. It's a center that is going to be a prime part of our campus. And it really is pushing this idea that success is about holistic wellness, and that's everyone's responsibility on campus.
I love that. I mean, that's something that I don't think we talk about. It doesn't always strike you as an academic thing to talk about, and yet it is so important. And we know students especially have so much more stress and anxiety than they've always had. So that is great.
Young people today are more anxious, lonely, exhausted than ever before. We know that's the case. And we also know that you can't be academically excellent or excellent in work if you're not taking care of yourself outside of the classroom or outside of your job. We also know that women tend to put themselves last in these situations. Once they have families, they're taking care of families and they're dealing with work, and they tend to put themselves in last place. And so the question is, how can we start early with students to think about them thinking about how they maintain their well-being? And it's not just physical well-being, it's mental well-being. And a third part of this center that I'm so excited about, it's based on three pillars: physical well-being, mental well-being, and something I think you'll be excited about is financial well-being. That's our third pillar. Right. With the idea being that young women need to understand their finances now and into the future. And without that power, well-being is not attainable. It's not just about exercise. It's not just about diet. Financial is the third prong here. And we really think this is going to be a model for how colleges and universities think about preparing their students.
So we care about that, as you know, very much. And we did pilot a program with you last year, which we continue this year, around financial literacy for the undergrads, especially freshmen and sophomores who really coming in could benefit from this. So talk about that kind of skill set, you know, learning that so early on, whether or not you've come from parents who've taught you these skills. How do you think the students have gravitated toward this information, and has it changed their confidence?
You know, I love that we're doing this program together around financial literacy and well-being. When we decided to partner with you, I just thought it was such a fantastic way to move this forward, because our students had been asking for this. And it turns out that for several years, we'd done financial literacy with seniors before they graduated, like how to do their taxes or how to think about negotiating. And what they always said was, this is great, but we need it way earlier. One thing that has been surprising to me is that the need for this information cuts across background of students. You know, I talked before about how important it is to have diverse students and students with diverse lived experiences, but whether you come from a well-off family or a family with much more need, our students, and especially as young women, are not versed in budgeting, in saving, in thinking about which health insurance plan to choose, and even thinking about investing. You know, it's just not something that's on their plate. And I've been struck by the fact that oftentimes their male counterparts are thinking about these things. They're maybe getting it in other ways, whether it's at home or they're getting it from peers. And it's something that every student should come out with a grasp of. And it's something that's so important for the rest of their lives.
So you've been working with students for 20 years and probably seen a lot of different attitudes when it comes to money, finances. Has anything changed over this time, particularly with women? Do you find their approach to money has evolved?
You know, it's interesting. I think that there's still a lot of ignorance out there about what students should be paying attention to, or this idea that I'll think about saving later, or understanding how to live on a budget, how to think about investing. I mean, I worry that our young women are just pushing it off to later. And so that's why I think it's so important what we're doing and bringing financial literacy front and center as a component of well-being, because I think it's something that students should be thinking about early. You know, even how you do your taxes, that's an important thing, but how do you understand a lease agreement? How do you understand your student loans? What are you thinking about with respect to credit cards? Is it something your parents are just doing for you? Where do you get that information? And I think it goes back again to this idea that sometimes parents or family members know what to do and they're not explaining it or being explicit about it. These are such important things to start early.
And especially with students who will be managing debt for a while after coming out of school, so student debt in particular, how do you help them think through the plan for paying that off, their career choices, and how that might affect their ability to pay?
Yeah, I mean, Barnard, I think, is a special place because we meet full financial need. And on average, our students who are in financial aid come out in total after 4 years with about $16,000 in debt. So it's very little. But oftentimes, students who are first generation or low-income backgrounds, the idea of having any debt is really, it's negative, which is understandable. And as they think about graduate school or other avenues, I think trying to understand the trade-offs. What does debt now give you in terms of job security or even financial means in the future? How do you want to think about that? And we help them try and chart out a path. Maybe a student works for a couple of years before they think about a graduate program. How do we give them information about what different sorts of careers offer in terms of financial ramifications? So, you know, it's helping give the student tools to educate their family. I had a young woman tell me a story about how she was really interested in going to get a PhD in the humanities, but her parents, you know, who were first generation, low income, wanted her to think about a career as a lawyer or a doctor, the areas that they perceived to be most financially successful. And it was about giving that student tips and tools to have conversations with her parents that actually the best PhD programs will pay for you to get your entire PhD, right? And that there can be benefits that come with being an academic in terms of job security, in terms of helping to pay for your own kids' college. But it's about arming students with the tools to have those conversations. Or a student who wants to major in something that their parents don't think is going to be the most lucrative major, but again, showing the parents the data and the student the data that, I mean, at least with Barnard, it absolutely does not matter what you major in. You can go into any job from any major, and you could go to medical school with an English major as long as you have the prerequisites. And sometimes that's even better. I'm a big data person. So spelling out the data so that students can follow their passions and are armed with the ability to make the right decisions. And, you know, part of that also is making sure that our students are supported to do internships across different nonprofits and other areas. And we spend a lot of philanthropic dollars and our own resources to provide stipends to students to do internships. So they're not making a decision between working versus an internship that will allow them to explore a different career. And we know that internships are so important to taking steps in different businesses. And so we have a huge internship program that allows students to go work at different companies, different nonprofits. And in many cases, Barnard will foot the bill to support that student to have those experiences.
Are there areas, the financial literacy areas, that you're trying to instill lessons around that have to do with long-term independence? So in other words, many women will go on to have relationships and marriages, and they might have a spouse or partner ultimately helping them make these decisions. But how do you ensure women always have their own either financial stability, independence, or just the knowledge so that no matter where they are in life, they'll be able to count on themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such an important issue, and it's an issue of well-being, which is why we're going to have finances as part of our new Francine LaFrac Center, because we know that women often stay in relationships for financial reasons, and that women even who are successful or in their own careers aren't overseeing their own finances. And so these are part of the financial literacy conversations. They're going to be part of our new well-being center. I'm acutely aware of this now, even just from some of the research coming out, that many women during COVID are making the decision to step back from work. I think a recent report by the Wall Street Journal talked about 1 in 4 women making that step back. You know, the question is, how do you have the conversations not about this moment, but what it means 5 years, 10 years down the line? And we know that it's harder to come back into the workforce, and especially for professional women in some sort of leadership role. And I mean, this moment is no doubt hard. I mean, it's so difficult for so many. And I think, you know, we're definitely relatively lucky being able to work from home in so many ways. But as we know, women are taking a brunt of the double labor at home and at work. And the reflex to step back now without thinking long term could be really detrimental.
And in a similar vein, do you talk to women about when they start thinking about having families and once the crisis obviously over, you know, just the fact that if they become parents, this often interrupts people's careers as well. And how should they be thinking about that? How should they set themselves up so they can stay in the workforce if they want to, but they can also manage additional family responsibilities?
I think there's not a one size fits all here. I often think the most powerful thing is to talk to as many women who've had different experiences in this area to understand what they've done. And I think some industries do this better than others. So, for example, I actually think the legal profession does a pretty good job where women often go part-time at their firm or other things and can come back. I don't think all industries have figured it out. You know, even academia, where you can stop the clock of tenure to have a child, there's research showing that the stop the clock is actually more beneficial for men because they continue to work while the clock is stopped and the women aren't working on their research, they're taking care of their kids. So this uniform policy ends up having a negative effect and backfiring on women. So then when they come up for tenure, they're being evaluated the same across the stop the clock, but the women who were stopped really were stopped.
Right.
Places like Beyond Barnard are great for our alums to come and check out resources and talk to other people. But I think this brings up a larger issue about, I would argue, each company and each industry needs a toolbox of strategies, right? So what are the on-ramps? How are companies that profess to wanting to create a diverse workforce, what are they doing to actually help that? And it can't be one size fits all, because I don't think the one size fits all works. And the tenure policy, I think, is a good example of that. How can we use changes in remote work to help benefit who stays and who doesn't? We often know women can't move in the same way to take a job in another city. Could the fact that we don't have to be in the office every day change how companies are able to recruit? You know, could you recruit someone who primarily lives on the West Coast, who can't move her family, who might be an underrepresented minority, to work in New York, but not be there all the time, right? I mean, how are we going to think about this differently? Because it's not about professing just to want to have this diversity. It's figuring out the policies that allow it to happen.
We absolutely agree with that. And interestingly, while one size might not fit all across companies, it might not even within the company, depending on the jobs and the things that you need to do. So we talk a lot in career development about sponsors, having sponsors really there as an important relationship to pull you up, give you new assignments, right? Put you in positions where you can grow. Has there been a sponsor who, in the process of just pushing you to be better, gave you feedback that was hard to take, but because you had trust with this person, you knew it was in your best interest and it helped you in the end? You listened to it?
Yeah. First of all, it's the way I lead. I give very direct feedback, and it's often always not positive. And I expect the people I lead to give me that same feedback or input. And I learned that from sitting around a table, watching people in team meetings argue with each other and watching the fact that better ideas came out of these different opinions, and that what was most important was to create a space where people felt comfortable voicing the non-popular opinion or a different perspective or view. I remember when I went into the provost office at the University of Chicago after being faculty for 10 years and the president, I wrote a report on something and he gave me feedback. I'd sort of pitted one area against another and he was like, this is not the right way to approach this. The right way is not to approach it as they're competing against each other. The right way to approach it is how they work together to get to an end result. And it fundamentally changed my view about how I was proposing something. And that the university was working as a system. I had to figure that out. And so, you know, I listen. The students always ask me about successes. And I say, you know, ask me about mistakes too, because I make mistakes all the time. And that's important and okay.
And in that situation where you got that feedback, how did you process it? At first, were you defensive at all? Or did you think, oh, maybe there's a point here and it'll let you move on to see things in a different way?
I think over the years, I've learned to be less defensive as, you know, I get feedback and to stop and think about it more before I respond. There's certainly been times where I've cried in my office I think we all have those times. I think we should be talking about them. But, you know, then I picked myself up and figured out how to do it a different way. And I think I asked someone else for help. I asked to see another example of a report. I think that if we're not failing or things are not hard at certain points, we're not pushing ourselves to our full potential. And I've really tried to get away from this idea that everything I do the first time has to be perfect. And it's hard. It's hard because I'm a woman. It's hard because I'm a high achiever. It's hard because I'm a type A personality. And I remember in third grade, like trying to write my report, and I wanted the first draft to be my last draft because it should just be a one shot. And so that carries me everywhere. But I've really tried to walk away from that. And I push myself to do it because I know that better ideas and agendas and systems evolve over time and with that feedback.
So tell us as we leave, what is something that makes you hopeful about the future for women?
You know, our students, these women are going to go out and change the world. And I know young people are not going to stand by and go back to the old normal with our systemic inequality, issues around healthcare, race, education. I mean, I have so much confidence and pride in the young women I see, and I can't wait to see what they produce next. And if you're on a college campus all the time, I think everyone would see that optimism as well, because there's some amazing women who are doing amazing things already and who will go out and really have an impact on how we think, how we take care of ourselves and the world and each other.
Well, Sian, thank you so much for sharing all your insights with us and the wonderful things that are happening at Barnard under your leadership, and for leaving us with such a high note. So we wish you the best, and we can't wait to see you on campus when we can again.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It was great.
I'm so grateful to Sian for spending time with me. Her research background makes her uniquely positioned to guide young women on not just their education, but also their well-being. The meaningful changes she's making at Barnard to reduce the cognitive load on students are great lessons to consider implementing in all sectors. The mission of Women on the Move is to help women in their professional and personal lives. Our goal is to introduce you to people with great ideas, inspiring stories, and a passion to make a difference. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss any others. For JPMorgan Chase's Women on the Move, I'm Sam Saperstein. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. is a member of the FDIC.